Welcome back to another episode of the Magnus and Marcus podcast. I'm here with John Marcus as always. Welcome, John.
Hey, Steve. Glad to be back, alive, breathing, and still kicking in 2015.
Yep, still making it in the middle of indoor season, so surviving. So this week we discussed talking about a topic that I think will be pretty interesting, basically summed up as transitioning, right? And I think we can look at this from a number of different perspectives, which I know we will, but, you know, from our world or our worldview, we have transitions from coming from high school kids, coming into our programs at the college university setting. And then we also have another big transition, which is coming from college to, for those who make it, the professional setting, which I think both kind of present their own unique and different challenges.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's when you think about transitioning, it's all about, you know, kind of interconnects a lot of stuff we've already talked about, like the clean slate phenomenon, you know, other different aspects, but it's so much more this kind of interesting psychological study, because I feel like you're transitioning different environments, not only physically, but mentally and emotionally, as well as like raising the level of expectation about what's competent, what is competitive, and then what's ultimately highly, highly excellent, right? Because, you know, being an excellent high school cross-country or track and field athlete doesn't necessarily mean you be an excellent or highly competitive Division I track and field athlete. Maybe the state you're in or the division you're in is going to translate well to NAIA D3, and then so on and so forth. You know, maybe being a really highly competitive Division I track and field athlete doesn't going to mean you're going to get in and all of a sudden go to the Olympics and medal in the Olympics. So it's not these givens that just because you're playing a game at this division or these levels, that the next level is going to be a smooth, linear progression. And so many times I think, you know, there's a tendency to forget about life, even though we draft it and kind of plot it as linear. The reality is it's very, you know, it's like the Dow Jones market. It's up and down, baby. So, you know, it's how do we create a linear trend or a smooth progressional trend when you step back from a global perspective and look at over the course of 5, 6, 7 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, but not get too caught up in the ups and downs that happen kind of from the moment to moment, week to week, month to month, you know, progression.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, from the college standpoint, I know I see a lot of kids when they come into a new program, new environment, is they're so used to seeing, taking this acute view, right? And it's, mm-hmm. it's this workout to workout success, or one race to the next race success, that has this almost overarching, defining, their success for the season. And what happens is you get, it's not this linear progression, like you said, and it's these bumps and valleys and peaks and valleys on all this stuff. But when you're coming at it from moving on to a new program, thinking, oh, this is college, I'm going to run fast, is you get so drawn into these minute changes that you lack the ability to step back, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know, I think sometimes what I've noticed with freshmen having coached high school and coached college, and even, you know, what I call freshmen post-collegiates, you know, people who are just out of college, new into the scene, you know, it's this really tough reality where your junior, senior year, you finally have figured out that landscape and that environment and that, you know, level of expectation, competency, competitiveness, and what you need to be to be successful there. And then you get ripped from high school. You get ripped from the college ranks. You get thrust into this even more competitive environment, more cutthroat environment relative to where your previous were. And people start to freak out on you. You know, and I always tell freshmen, especially, it's like, freshmen, you guys are allowed every season, if we're talking the three-season typical collegiate cycle, cross-country, indoor, and outdoor, you guys are allowed about 3 bad workouts a season. You know, and if, because it's going to happen. You're going to stay up too late. You're going to stress out about a midterm. You're going to stress out about, you know, a new boyfriend or picking up with a boyfriend. You know, those things will happen, and you might come to workout day and be like, hey, you know what, you can just lay an egg on that day. And because we're kind of wedded to that structure of workout days as a group activity in the college system. We don't have the luxury as the post-collegiate athlete, like you say, look, you look awful, you don't look ready to go today, we're going to move you or your workout back a day or two. But the thing is, it's noticed, like, those hiccups will happen. Now, if it's a trend, if it's 5, 6, 7 workouts don't go well or up to plan or up to your capacity, then there's a much bigger issue at heart about how you overall adapting rather than transitioning to the environment and recognizing what those levels of stress, what those self-sabotage items are in your life, whether it's, you know, the big three, sleep, nutrition, hydration, or if it's something else that's a little bit more complex, a little bit more subtle, but equally important.
Exactly. I mean, we have a concept, we call it winning the workout. If you win way more workouts than you lose, we're on a good projected trend and things will translate into the race. If we start losing more workouts than we win, we're on a bad cycle. It's just like you said, we look at it in terms of our kind of broken down seasons. And if we start seeing, you know, losing one workout every week and a half or so, week and a half to 2 weeks, then we know we're doing a bad job. If the workouts were continually walking away from them, feeling pretty good about them, then we know it's going to translate into the races eventually if it hasn't yet. So I think that's a good point being made. You know, one of the other things I see, whether it's high school or professionally, is this comparison. Is that people are so used, you go from your, let's say, your high school environment or even your college environment, where you're used to racing the same people at your high school state meets or your conferences in college. You're used to racing these guys all the time. And you establish this pecking order, right? And then you go off to your separate colleges or your separate professional domains. And then just because of the transition, sometimes that pecking order just gets messed up a little bit, right? And all of a sudden, right, you're beating people who you've never beat before. And then there's people who you never lost to who are beating you. And I know that's something that a lot of really good athletes, I think, coming out of high school or college, struggle with to a degree.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about, you know, too, I think, your form of your worldview, right?
Right.
So we have, like, in the high school ranks, there's different divisions within the state. Most people are just focused in on how they compare in their division, you know, in their state, maybe. And, you know, the little higher level type athletes of the high school ranks, they have a broader, you know, view of how they compare, you know, nationally. Very few high school kids are thinking how they compare globally. How do they compare to the distance runners in Kenya, the throwers in Germany, the high jumpers in Russia? They're not thinking that, right? And then even in college, too, there's a little bit of a narrow-mindedness of focusing in on either how you compare within your conference, within your region, or within your division. You know, like I was talking to a former Division I runner friend of mine, and we're talking about, you know, the difference, exactly this, like, who's the best distance runner in college? Who's the best pole vaulter in college? Is it the person with the fastest mark now? Right now in the heart of the season, or is it the person who wins the championship? But the Division II national champion in, like, the 400-meter hurdles might be better than Division I national champion in the 400-meter hurdles, but they didn't get a race on the championship day at the same place at the same time. So we have a tendency to, you know, kind of create this elitism where, well, Division I's the best, that has the highest density of competitive talent in the nation for the college ranks. But that's not to say you might have a really good D2, D3, or NAIA athlete that can compete. And maybe if they're on the race the right day at the championship right alongside those guys, an NAIA, you know, miler might actually be the best collegiate miler in the nation. But we just really don't know because of this comparative bias or this elitism about, that we just say this and this and this. And you take that one step further when you then graduate of college and you've been focused on Division II or Division I, what have you. Now all of a sudden you're post-collegiate and it's like, well, now you're looking at this blanket, let's say for distance running, all the distance runners in the nation, right? But the trouble there is there's so many different championships from a national class perspective. You have the 15K road championship, You have the cross country, you know, winter championships and club championships. You have USATF indoors and outdoors. You have the USATF half marathon championships. And the whole idea, you know, sometimes of a championship event is all the best people, all the athletes are bringing their best to that championship on that day. It's what makes it a true championship. Like you have the high school state meet or, you know, the indoor, outdoor, cross country collegiate championships, whatever division you have. You don't really get that post-collegiately in American and USATF world, right? Because someone might just say, well, I'm really peaking for the marathon, USATF marathon championships, and then that precludes them from running USATF outdoors or the cross country championships. So, you know, it's again kind of stepping back and looking at that more global perspective and then adjusting to that. And then one step further, even on the post-collegiate scene, is the is not only the national comparison, but the global comparison, right? You want to be an Olympian. Hey, that's great, but now do you want to go to the Olympics and get out in the first round? Or do you want to be an Olympian and compete to win a medal? How do you stack up against the best in, you know, Kenya, Japan, Ethiopia, you know, Britain, and all those types of things? So, and I think that, to me, mentally and emotionally, that's the biggest shock, is people are prepared for the comparison analysis jump they have to make from division or from, you know, high school to college to post-collegiate, because however you shape your worldview, however acute or broad it is going to impact then how you're going to approach your training, your motivation for it, and your also view of yourself. Like, you might be the hot shot in your conference, but you're not qualifying to regionals or nationals at the Division I level. Or you might be, you know, setting American records, but the event you're in is, you know, something like the triple jump, which America is not really that competitive at in a world view, and an American record of triple jumps might not be that good at compared to where the world is in triple jumping prowess at the
moment. Exactly. I mean, that's a huge point. And I think what happens there is the way I look at it is when we see these different jumps of world views, you know, your conference to your national view, to your world view, to whatever it is. As I look at them as people create these different, like, benchmarks and set points, they create these comparison points, right? And within their own little world, you know, of their conference championship, they might be a stud. So they create this viewpoint of, like, this is good for me. This is my benchmark. If I do better than this, I'm a good runner. And what happens, so I'll give you an example with my team. When I came in, is we had some really talented runners at Houston, but their benchmark was set so low, their expectations were so low because they weren't exposed to even the national college scene, right? So when I came in, it was perceived as fast to run. You know, I think our school record was like 8:22 in the 3K, right? And it was perceived as fast if you ran sub 4:10 in the mile, because that meant, hey, you might score at conference. So the worldview was so small, and just by expanding that and exposing those guys to, you know, national caliber college kids or national caliber, world-class caliber athletes, and saying, like, hey, this is the actual worldview. And just by exposing them, and sure, a little bit of training, but exposing them, like, their expectations and their norms just jumped. So now it's at, you know, now we have a couple low weight minute 3K guys, and we have walk-ons running 8:20s, and it's because 8:20 is no longer seen as fast. It's just like, oh, this is something we should do, because that benchmark changes. So if you can get them to adapt in the correct way and respond to thinking of that benchmark as a new norm, a new challenge that can be accepted, then I think you transition in a healthy way. The unhealthy way is when you look at that transition, and you see this on the pro side a lot, is you look at the Kenyan runners, let's say Dibaba running 14:18 indoors this past weekend, and you see that as 14:18, oh my God, that's untouchable. And now instead of having this benchmark to grade yourself off, you've created this ceiling, this wall, that is untouchable, unbelievable. I can't ever get close to that, right? So I think that mindset right there has a huge impact on how well you transition from, you know, phase to phase.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing you have, especially when records are set. People put athletes on pedestal, and athletes, competitors put our athletes on pedestal, saying, well, they're the collegiate record holder or American record holder or conference record holder or world record holder. And so now when, you know, that record holder who's hit this time trial mark goes to a championship meet, they are then regarded as, all right, we're all just playing for second place type deal. And the reality is when you go to a championship meet, championship style racing is not time trial racing with rapids and pacers going out of these speeds and everything nice orchestrated and set up with perfect conditions on this day. Like, championship style racing, if you're having the, you know, NCAA championship in Houston, Texas for a 10K, that's a much different reality than having it at, you know, Palo Alto at Stanford and hitting that really fast mark. And so I think, too, it's also realigning about why you're doing what you're doing. Are you just trying to run really, really fast and compare yourself to past comparison or past incarnations of you, or about what's quote-unquote good now, or are you really trying to focus yourself, you know, to be a championship competitor? And so, again, it's really crafting and recrafting that worldview. I mean, one of the critical things I always remind student-athletes is Frank Shorter, one of the greatest distance runners ever in American folklore and history, didn't PR at all in high school until his junior year of college. Didn't, you know, run his lifetime best compared to his high school self for 2 years, you know. And when you think about that and then what he went on to accomplish later on with his, you know, his medals and, you know, his marathon prowess and all that great stuff, is had he, you know, just said, oh, now I suck at running, you know, I'm no good at this, and just moved on, we would never have the story that was Frank Shorter's legacy of competing and racing. And that's something that is to be inspired by that person who might not be hitting, you know, all-time PR marks their first year of college, because the workloads in the classroom and the workloads on the sport of play and also the amount of time to invest in new relationships and new friendships is really, really high and emotionally draining, and, you know, it's just not all clicking right away. Or even your sophomore year, right? You go through that sophomore slump. Like, you had such a great first freshman year, and, like, maybe you're the baby, you know, apple of everyone's eye. Your freshman year, you broke like school freshman record. You ran great at conference because you just had kind of that beginner's mindset of, hey, this is fun. I'm just running. This is great. You know, and then your sophomore year is all this expectation to get a lot better. I've seen this so many times as well. And then the weight of the world, you know, kind of comes crashing down a little bit because now coach has his expectation on you. Your teammates do. You do. And maybe you're in like a nursing program and all of a sudden you're doing these trying to use clinicals where you're on your feet for 10 to 15 hours a week. You know, so it's always shifting. It's always changing. So this idea of a linear progression is very, very rare. And when it does happen, when people get faster throughout the course of the season and or the course of their career, that's really something to applaud and champion because, you know, as much as we want to think that's the norm, that's actually a very well-orchestrated exception. You look at a lot of people's track records. Very few, you know, collegians and post-collegians get significantly better every race they run, even though that's the absolute end game and goal, every race throughout a season, and ultimately make huge jumps of improvement every single season. It just is not the case.
Yeah, exactly. It's a much, much more jagged road to the top. Which I think is something that we don't really appreciate that much because we see it as this kind of stair-stepping model for some reason, but it's not that at all, which is interesting. But, you know, getting back to what you were talking about a little bit is one of the things I always think about is how to manage those expectations once you get good. So one of the things that you mentioned a little bit and that I've seen a lot is that oftentimes you hit a struggle after a big breakthrough because all of a sudden, you know, you take your performance to another level. Let's say you're that freshman kid, comes in wide-eyed, has no expectations, sets all sorts of records. Then the next year comes around and it's like, oh my gosh, like I'm at this level. Now I have to get to this next level. And they almost start trying to force it, right? They're trying to push it. And trying to force things to happen when their freshman year, they were all about kind of letting it come to them and letting themselves to develop. It's almost that case where naivety is a bonus, right? Once we know a little bit too much, it becomes a drawback. It's hindering. It's like a, you know, how many times have you heard the story of the, you know, kind of naive freshman come in, doesn't know anything about running, just takes off because of the new training and all that stuff. And then they start becoming aware of how good they actually are. And all of a sudden it's slump time. So I think managing those expectations and almost pre-preparing for it, if you see someone going through a really big breakthrough, is huge. Like, mentally dealing with those big breakthroughs is what sets you apart in terms of having some of those setbacks or having that more jagged versus that linear path that we kind of talked about.
Right. I think what you see is a support network in place for those athletes that are able to progress after that big breakthrough, or maybe, you know, the comparison of someone, X person beat you in high school all the time, but then you got to college and then you beat person X all the time in college, even though they're better than you in high school. You know, maybe that's a product of many, many things, but my heart to heart is telling me, like, mostly it's about the support network created in that collegiate setting or in that post-collegiate setting. And that's what you see, you know, most often, or I see most often with post-collegiates and immediate post-collegiates, is they go from this really cohesive, supportive environment where everything's taken care of in college, like, how are you getting the meets? What's the travel schedule? What's the itinerary? Per diem? Okay, you got a sports physio, you know, med person on site, a masseuse, you know, you got, hey, you got free shoes coming here, you got free clothing here, you got good coaching here, you have a nice, neat setup of a calendar, a racing calendar, and this is the races that we're all going to say are the most important and train you and peak you for. And then you get post-collegiate as a distance runner, it's like, hey, you can do whatever you want. You can run cross-country, you can run road, you can run track, you can run all three in 3 weeks if you want. You know, you got to pick which championship you want to do. Oh, hey, you also got to pay bills and there's no scholarship going on. You got to pay a coach. You know, you got to get an agent. You got to get into meets now. And before, your coaches were getting you into meets. You can get into meets because of the collegiate meet. And now you got to wiggle your way in to that start line. You know, there's so many different loopholes and there's so many different obstacles that the immediate post-collegiate has if they don't have the right infrastructure or support, you know, for them. That it gets a little disheartening and it gets a little discouraging when it was just so easy in college. So I think, too, as someone, you know, as people who are looking to run post-collegially, or if you are running post-collegially, you know, understand that your support network is really, really critical. Like, how do you go into a new city? Like, maybe you go into a city because there's a really good coach there, okay? Well, you believe in that coach, and then hopefully that coach can help connect you and, you know, whether you're remote in a different city and coaching you via email or Skype or whatever, or if you're in the same city with a good, you know, physio and sports med person, a good masseuse and a good chiropractor, and, you know, do you have the budget for that? Are you blessed to be signed by a shoe company or have multiple revenue streams and sponsorships that can get you blessed? Do you have a good agent who has sway to get you into these meets? You know, it's so much logistics. It's not just, hey, you're a too flat 800 girl, and you go pro now, and you tell them when you're going pro, and it's all great, and, you know, life's going to be peaches and cream. Well, guess what? It's not, because when you go pro, everyone's too flat in 100. You know, otherwise exactly. You wouldn't be pro. You know, it's not that special anymore. It's like English Gardner, right? English Gardner was the darling of sprinting track and field at Division I a couple years ago. Like, where is English Gardner? Like, I haven't heard... You know, yep. Track and Field News has been putting Liz Gardner on the cover of the magazine for a little while here, even though she was, like, you know, on that thing like every other issue in her junior and senior year of college at Oregon. So it's like, you know, you look to those types of people, and very rarely do you have that smooth transition that people have from the collegiate to the pro ranks. I mean, you look at Big Bad Andrew Weeding as an example. Very jagged, you know, Robbie Andrews, another very example, very jagged, a lot of success. And those guys were like, that was it, man. Robbie Andrews and Andrew Weeding going at each other. Like, that was those were the guys racing in the middle distances in the 800 and call it indoor and outdoor. Now it's like, well, Weeding's made it to the Olympics several times. You know, Andrews hasn't yet. He's working on it. You know, he's been bouncing, bounced between coaches, went with Vidge, went to Skaggs, back to Vidge. You know, same thing with Weeding, was with Van, now was with Roland. and you know, the jury's out, right? Because those guys are great guys who I love, but they're not having that same, you know, kind of like cataclysmic or, you know, like volcanic ascension that they did in college. It's much more jagged for those guys. Now, they're some of America's best middle distance talent right now on the men's side.
Exactly. You know, I was actually talking with Phoebe Wright the other day, who had a similar kind of experience, I think, transitioning from college to pro, that more jagged approach. And one of the good points she brought up is that when you're in college, right, it's like you said, it's all structured. You have everything taken care of. But also, running isn't your sole life, right? So you have all these distractions around you, which if taken right, taken well, is a good thing. So the people who run really fast in college, sometimes they run really fast because, you know what, they have this social support group and their teammates and their coaches and all that stuff. So it's instant social support where you're going to practice and you're not only working hard, right, but you have this whole group to kind of let out the steam of having to grind through the training. And then once training's done, well, you know what, you shift your focus, you go to class for a couple hours, you know, you worry about your real world stuff, and then you go back to training, right? When you get into the pro scene, a lot of athletes are like, oh man, I'm going to spend all my day focused on, you know, doing running related stuff and all the strength and all the little things. And I'm going to be able to take naps and recover, and it's going to be awesome. But what they kind of forget there is that they lose that whole social structure and that whole other meaning in their life structure of having something else to fall back on when running isn't going that well, right? So I think a lot of people fall into this mistake of putting everything around this kind of running perfection model and kind of forgetting that, hey, they ran really fast in college while going to class or while having this other social group. So And just taking all that time and sticking it to running doesn't always work the way you think it is. It might be best physically for your body, but mentally, emotionally, psychologically, maybe that outlet that you had in school or whatever other passion project you had during school isn't there anymore. And you don't have those, you know, 15, 20 other teammates every day to practice to kind of keep things light and going. Now it's maybe just you and your coach at the track, or you and, you know, a group of three other athletes who, you know, you might train with. So I think that's a huge component. I mean, I've seen really good athletes kind of fail to make that transition because they wrap themselves around doing everything right, which is, you know, admirable. But they forget that they had this outlet that is no longer there.
Exactly. And at the same time, yeah, it gets real trite real quick. I mean, it just, you're like, how much little auxiliary work can you do, or these little stretches or drills, you know, can become a neuroses at that level. I mean, one of the most intelligent things, or intelligent, I guess, mechanisms I've seen, like a pro athlete, is actually Nick Simmons. You know, Nick Simmons, everyone knows, you know, he likes to go fishing. The guy will just, he'll just go fishing for a day and not run and not train and totally just check out and fish. And, you know, you see that too kind of with what we've tried to adapt from the Kenyan lifestyle of their training camps, where they run, they eat, they sleep, they hang out, and then they go run again. Well, they're actually masters at idleness, right? When you think about this, in America, your weekend is supposed to be, okay, hey, I get to rejuvenate, regenerate. But what you do, your weekend is just as scheduled as your, you know, your work week. You have, you know, typically like, okay, the kids have soccer at this time, or you're meeting this person for lunch, or you're going to the movies at this time. And, oh, my God, you know, we're late for our dinner, you know, date at this our reservation at this time, right? And it's not like you're just sitting there with, you lose track of what time it is because you don't care. You know, you're not like, oh, man, is it, how close are we to noon because I have a conference call? Or, oh, I'm going to catch up on work and I'm going to, you know, send emails, or I'm going to catch up on my studies or whatever, right? Like, that's the value of that Kenyan idleness, where, like, you know, Simmons going out and fishing, is there's nothing going on and you actually really do get to rejuvenate and recuperate, just as you do when you're hanging out in college playing, you know, you know, Halo or whatever video game for a couple hours, just hanging with the twos, playing video games, and that has a space and time to rejuvenate. Or, you know, you're going out and you're just having cooking dinner with your team. No one's really worried for the next 3 hours when we're to do something. We're just cooking the meal as a group and having fun. So I think sometimes, too, I've seen, Steve, you're around St. Peter, I've seen, you know, people, you know, media posts just, you know, make that vow of sincerity to do everything, the big to the little things right, but then it blows up in their face and they start running slower than in college. And like, well, doing better workouts, getting more sleep, better nutrition, better recovery, more massage, better coaching, better this, better that, but yet I'm running 2 seconds faster or 2 seconds slower than 800 than in college. Why? And then it perpetuates this feeling of frustration. Well, you're not checking out enough. Sometimes we need to be able to check out.
Exactly.
Every now and again. And that's, you know, that's really important to being successful in transitioning, is understanding that coping, natural coping mechanism we have in place.
Exactly. I mean, that's huge. We could sit here and talk hours about, you know, looking at it from a restoring willpower you know, decreasing decision-making fatigue from making all these decisions to do all these little things. It all adds up, right? I've always said, if you want to be good at a distance runner, as a professional distance runner, you have to be really good and really okay with doing nothing for a long period of time and be completely okay with it. If you look at, you go over to Europe, it's run, sit around for 6, 7, 8 hours, maybe go to the coffee shop and run again and then go race, right? That's the lifestyle. And people, you either get neurotic about it or you use it as your Nick Simmons example, you use it as a restorative activity, right? And that's it. You hit the nail on the head with the African lifestyle. One of the things that I've talked a lot about with Sarah Hall is when she came back from a training trip in Ethiopia, she was like, oh, it's this lifestyle that does it. It's this, oh, who cares? Like, there is no time commitment, right? It's not scheduled, forced. It's not, oh, I have to be neurotic, hit these splits, you know, do this workout exactly at this time, do all these recovery things in between. It's get my work down, done, chill out, actually restore, don't stress about it, and then get things done, right? And it's that mindset, that lifestyle that us in the U.S. and Europe are really bad at, especially in the U.S. Like, we're neurotic. We have to always have something going on, and that is counterproductive to the distance running professional runner lifestyle, I think.
Yeah, 100%. Like, we, you know, with my completed distance kid, like, you know, we, for practice, we're on Kenyan time. Like, gathering time is 8:30 in the morning about. You know, but I'm not sitting here at 8:31. If you're not all here, every minute you're late, you're doing 10 push-ups.
Exactly.
You know? And that's the way we're conditioned in America, is time is money, you're being disrespectful if you're not on time. Well, you know, we just decided that when the sun in late February is here, that's going to correlate to a certain time on a digital watch on our hand. You know, and so, you know, we typically start gathering around, like, with my guys, 8:30 in the morning, and about 8:39 to 8:45, depending if people, you know, had trouble parking, you know, had to go to the bathroom, forgot their spikes in the locker room. You know, when everyone's ready, it's like, oh, hey, all right, guys, we're all ready? Okay, we're all right. Let's go in the vans and go to the forest to do our run, or let's go to the track to go do our workout. Like, but we're not sitting, and everyone, you know, it's been a really fun experiment, because we've never had to wait a half hour for someone. We've never had to wait till 9 o'clock to get going, you know, by someone being so egregiously late. Like, everyone's typically there within a 10-minute window of when we said that we start to gather. And so we've made that transition between gathering time and, okay, practice starts this time. But, you know, no one's ever been late for when we have to leave to get on a bus to go to a meet or leave to get to the airport. Everyone's always on time. So we're not teaching bad habits. What I'm trying to do is make it so, like, all right, that kid who accidentally woke up late for practice, now all of a sudden they get this boost of cortisol and they're stressing out. I'm like, oh man, I got oh crap, coach is gonna be pissing me, he's gonna be yelling at me, oh man, my teammates gonna be pissing me. It's like, no. Just let me know. You're gonna be 5-10 minutes late. Okay, well, we're cool with that. We wanna make sure you have a good workout, not that you just shot yourself from an adrenal standpoint because you're hustling to get to practice as quick as possible before you get penalized for it.
Exactly.
So, yeah, exactly. I mean, Kenyan time's a beautiful thing, as I like to call it, if you apply it appropriately. I mean, I learned this from Alfred Kipchumba when he was at University of Portland. I was coaching at UP. Like, it was what we called ALF time. But then, you know, we started to actually label what it was Kenyan time, where it didn't really, the KPIs, the key performance indicators, right, as they have in business, didn't matter about being on time to the minute on the track. It's about how you competed at the meet. So if you couldn't do the scheduled 16 times a quarter at, you know, 60 flat with 400 meter jogs in 3 minutes, you could only do 10. It wasn't like, oh my God, I'm going to run awful in 2 weeks at this meet. It was like, that's okay. I'll do better tomorrow. That's okay. It's okay. Like, that was, you know, Alf's trademark, but yeah, it's okay. It's okay. Don't worry. It's okay.
Exactly.
And then the guy goes and sets the school record, you know, at 10 minutes or 15 minutes after Trevor Dunbar does. Like, Dunbar ran 3:42 when he was at Portland. Kipchumba ran 3:40, falling race at Stanford. It was like, we call it ALF logic because it does. There was logical, you know, there was a logical progression. There was, you know, wisdom to his way of thinking. Like, it was ALF logic. It didn't make sense to our Western mindset. But it really did make sense if you step back and look at it.
Exactly.
Based on what actually happened on the track on the day when it mattered. He was there, ready to compete, fit, fired up, excited. Had he done two more quarters 2 weeks ago, maybe he wouldn't have been. Maybe he would have been a little better. He didn't know. But the end product, the KPI that really mattered about how you got on the track and competed was there. And so, yeah, I agree 100% from my experience with East African athletes, coaching them or being around them. Like, it is, Sarah Hall's right, it is the lifestyle and the values of that lifestyle that make them as good as they are in a lot of ways versus all these neurotic Americans trying to keep pace, so to speak.
Exactly. I mean, one of the other good points she brought up is she was amazed that, you know, someone would have a bad workout, drop out, and wouldn't face them at all. You know, us Americans, we'd be sitting there psychoanalyzing it, stressing over it, shooting cortisol through the roof until our next workout. And then we'd try and overcompensate on the next one to prove ourselves that, mm-hmm. you know, the last one was a fluke. And, you know, with them over there, it was like, oh, I just dropped out of a workout. I just got dropped hard. And there was still this confidence ability to be like, oh, I'm still good. Like, it doesn't matter. It's straight moved on. So it's mm-hmm. it's a fascinating mindset that I think a lot of us could learn a lot from. But that could be a topic for another time. We're approaching 40 minutes, so I think we'll.
This is our longest one to date, man. This is good.
I know. Got excited there towards the end. As I said, there's a lot of things we could delve into off of some of the topics brought up. So really enjoyed it, John.
Yeah, Steve, yeah, this was a lot of fun. So hopefully everyone listening at home found it of value, something to chew on and, you know, take forth to your coaching practice or at least you found our banter entertaining if you can't take anything from it. Thanks for listening.
Exactly. All right. Well, take care and look forward to chat more next time.
For sure. See you, Steve.